Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Real 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Squadron Leader?
Yes, I was born in Glasgow, 19th of July 1918, and I was christened officially, or registered officially, as John Blair, but my mother didn't like that. And altered the birth certificate by putting Ian in brackets. So when I subsequently have to produce my birth certificate for any official... So the birth certificate was altered manually by my mother. So in consequence, when it was produced, when I joined up particularly, I went to register as Ian Blair, boy apprentice, the recruiting officer said, but it's down here on your birth certificate as John. So henceforth, officially, I am known as John, but I was always called Ian by my colleagues, or Jock in general terms in the Royal Air Force.
Now, can you tell us a bit about your family background? Did you live in Glasgow?
Yes, I lived in St. Vincent Street in Glasgow, which is now, has all been demolished and is now a major eye hospital in Scotland. I used to go to school, walk to school.
Tell us a bit about your parents first. What did they do? What did your dad do for a living? Did your mother work?
My dad was... a superintendent of the stores department for the Glasgow Education Corporation, and which was in fact a superior supply officer, to put it in modern jargon. And he had a big organisation and fleet of transport which he controlled in Govan, the rough part of Glasgow. He also was a very keen amateur radio enthusiast. Not that he transmitted, but he listened worldwide to all shortwave broadcasts. Having been in the Royal Engineers during the First World War in the signal section, he was very enthusiastic. In fact, he was so enthusiastic, he took me to meet... a number of the well-known BBC engineers. Uncle Mike also was a broadcaster. I met him. They seemed to have a comradeship with all these senior guys, and not surprising, because it was just after the war. I remember my dad making a first radio set, and... listening to the station 2LO and Uncle Mike, that was the thing. It was very crude, but he was very keen, and he progressed over the years.
Did you share that interest with him?
No, I had absolutely no interest in radio at all, for some reason or other. So suffice to say, but what I did have in common, as I... got a little bit older. My dad joined the Royal Auxiliary Air Force, 602 Squadron, which will figure later.
Okay, we'll come up. Now tell me about your education then. Let's go back to that. That'd be the next thing, I think.
I went progress through the normal infant and elementary school, and I went to subsequently we had a set of we didn't call it 11 plus, but it was a qualifying examination which sent me off to grammar school in Glasgow. And it was Alan Glen's High School, which literally was. It was right up on the, it was high. But apart from that, I stayed there 4 years, and I did engineering, drawing, and chemistry, and physics and mechanical engineering. So
was that what you were interested in?
Yeah, I didn't go for the languages. Came on the fourth year. I was just doing German when I decided that I would leave.
Did you enjoy the school? I mean, was it a good school?
Oh, it was an excellent school. School was excellent. Good teachers. They were great sporting. It was a good classy school. I mean, it was well known in the city. Next to Glasgow Academy, it was running a good second.
What about sport? Was it were you interested in
school
sport?
Had plenty of sport, rugby and football, and to say that it was it was a boys' school and there was no co-education. I went there and I had
Were you interested in sport, or was that not your thing?
No, not at that time.
Did you have any
comes along best. Pardon?
Did you have any big hobbies while you were at school, or were you in any
of
the boys?
Yeah, I was keen on aeroplanes.
How did you come to be keen on aeroplanes?
Well, as I was saying earlier on, my dad joined the Auxiliary Air Force subsequently, in about 1925-ish, 602 Squadron, and I used to attend at the Renfrew, where was the base, regularly at the weekends, and I was able to roam around aeroplanes, and 602 Squadron had, at that time, its CO was the Marquess of Clydesdale, and McIntyre, the flight was the adjutant. People like that I met. My dad was a mechanic, a radio mechanic, AC2, and he had two colleagues, a fitter and a rigger, similar status, and a corporal friend, whom we used to go and take lunch in the corporal's club. Suffice to say, my mother was likewise had some interest in the Auxiliary Air Force. There were great social thing going on, and in consequence, at that period, I'm talking now about 1933-34, Alan Cobham was in the public eye, Bert Hinkler, Amy Johnson, Jim Wallison, all the famous pioneer aviators were doing their own thing, and Alan Cobham in particular used to give public lectures, and he lectured in Glasgow, and my mother and used to literally, she didn't have to drag me there, but we used to go and we used to listen to his lectures. So I became fascinated, about his exploits, and then Renfrew Airfield, which was the home of the local auxiliary squadron, used to field quite regularly, every year anyway, they had an air show, and it was at this one of these air shows that my dad introduced me to the various people, including the Duchess of Bedford, I seem to remember, as one character. I met Jim Mollison, Amy Johnson, and I also met L.P. Jones. L.P. Jones, yes, the Imperial Airways pilot who was there given us flights. And as I said, at one of these shows, Alan Cobham was there flying an aircraft, and I got my very first trip, like many boys, with Alan Cobham and his circus. So that's
sort of... You got a trip flying with Alan Cobham?
Cost my dad £5, I think, so, in old money. But I...
Now, what do you remember of that flight? I mean, did Cobham actually fly you himself?
Yeah, he was actually... I can't remember if it was a DH-50. It was a biplane. I can't remember what it was, actually. I think it's a DH-50. Yeah, I remember the fact it was not a very good day. It was, but it was suffice to say we flew around the Clyde and saw the ships, and the old Queen Mary was on the stocks, if I seem to remember, still being built then. She was laying up there, and round the River Cart, and round. Yeah, it was a very fascinating. University, of course, was another thing I see very clearly, but.
Did he fling it about a bit?
No, straight and level, circuit.
Just so you weren't airsick
nothing like that. No. A very gentle flight. It was done to give people, in very common air experience, you know, no aerobatics.
Did you speak to him, or did he speak
No, we could see him. We didn't have any contact with him at all. The mere fact he was flying it seemed to be adequate for us. We had a lot of confidence.
And you enjoyed it.
Yeah, we enjoyed that. That was a... And then, we, as I say, we on the ground, we met numerous other people of pioneers. One of them was John Tranum, I think, a parachutist. I think he was a Norwegian or a Swede. He pioneered rocket propulsion up in the Orkneys subsequently, sending letters by rocket from one island to another. There was a lot of interest, a lot of history was being made. We didn't know it was being made. And the other guy we met was, it was John's, wasn't it? John's, who wrote the Biggles books.
W.E. Johns.
Johns, yeah. He was a captain, yeah. I remember meeting him as well. O.P. There was an O.P. Jones and a Johns.
W.E.
Yeah. But by that time I was probably about 15-ish.
Had you been in the Boys Brigade or Boy Scouts?
I was in the Boy Scouts. Oh, yes, I was.
Now tell us about you, because we're quite interested, because they are quite military in origin.
Well, I've been in the Cubs. The 31st Claremont, I think that was Claremont Street Group. I was in the Cubs and then I went into the Scouts. They were based not far from where I lived, so it was no difficulty. People in these days accepted that. But the thing I remember about the Scouts was we had a group leader by the name of Charlie Anderson, who had been a wireless telegraphist in the Navy during the First World War, but he became a very famous scouter, if that's the right expression. Well liked, very well disciplined, and very smart. He always wore a kilt and a sort of khaki jacket, leather buttons, immaculately, always turned, and he insisted on all the boys turning out immaculately, which of course we did, and his section, of course, of senior scouts were all very good.
And what sort of activities did he organise and do with you? I mean, how military was it? What sort of things were you doing?
We went regularly to weekend camps. Can't remember where it was now, but it was outside Glasgow. It was, we packed up our gear and off we went and pitched our tents and cooked our own food. And as boys, had a right good time over the weekend. We used to do an annual trip to Ballater. We used to take the group used to go to Ballater a fortnight in the summer, and I went there a number of years, right on the banks of the Dee, and the outings were to Braemar and Balmoral Castle, Cratty Church, and these places. And we went, one year we went to Jersey, and we were in a field overlooking St. Brillad's Bay. That was he took us a day trip to Mont Saint-Michel, which is off the coast of France. Got some good pictures that are taken in these years. But the group, the point about the group was that it was a very great spirit. The guys worked well together, didn't seem to be any animosity, and the age groups went right through to the senior guys who were, 20, I suppose. But it was unfortunate that when the war broke out, a lot of the members of the troop went into the Navy, and I was four of my particular, two in my patrol and two in the next patrol, four of them were on the HMS Hood. And of course, being Glasgow guys, they never came back. They hopefully lost. But that was one sad thing that I always remember. But
and when did you leave school, and what were you going to do? I think we can guess what you were going to do.
Yeah, I was going to say that in the 1930s, the only way to get into the Royal Air Force, which was the ambition of a lot of young people, you had to set a national examination. And this national examination was held in the local Glasgow Corporation Education Department, which was not far from where I lived. I lived in the centre of the city anyway. So we went along there and we did this examination.
Now, what was it like? What was it examining you in?
I've actually got the papers there. Sample. It was a three-hour science paper and a three-and-a-half-hour general knowledge paper. I think it was about 6 hours. I've got some of the original papers. In fact, I've got my original examination paper in my folder there. But the having said that, we had to be a given age, not younger than 16 and a quarter, which was the... And the examination was for entry to Halton as an aircraft apprentice. The Minister of Defence, or Air Ministry as it was in these days, used to cream off the top 100 guys who successfully completed the examination to enter as Halton apprentices. Now, at that period of time in 1933-34, the Air Force was beginning to expand because of the political requirements and things which were happening around us. And they introduced a new system, new scheme called Boy Entrance, which really meant basically that boys joining under that scheme would serve 2 years apprenticeship and 9 years on the regular force, as opposed to the Halton apprentices who spent 3 years on apprenticeship and 12 years. So when the results were ultimately promulgated, I didn't get in the first 100, which disappointed me. But within a matter of days, in comes another letter saying, explaining the fact that I hadn't achieved a high enough standard in the first 100. I came to about 165 or something. But they had opened up this new system of boy entrance. So as I'd reached the appropriate age, etc., and had a good standard of education, they were prepared to offer me this 2 years and 9 years on the reserve. So,
now, when was it that you took this exam? When, what month was it, or what year was it you took the exam?
34. July, I think it was about July 34, actually. July 34. Certainly, the results were out, and...
How did your family react when you told them what you were going to
do? Well, my dad, there was no... There was no resistance. In fact, my dad got his CO, who was Marcus of Clyde's CO, 602 Squadron, to sign one of the references. So it was, my mother was just as keen. But we're disappointed that I hadn't got the Halton. But anyway, to cut the long story short, I was accepted as boy intern. You under training. So at that time, between July and the August, July and the September of the same year, 34, I had my railway warrant, and I was off down to West Drayton. Pardon me, West Drayton for attestation. I think that's the phrase they use. But we stopped at Uxbridge one night, and then were taken on to West Drayton for the remainder of the time. Now, at the attestation, or selection, call it what you will, you were mingling with numerous other boys, and you went. First of all, you had to get the dreadful medical, which was common. I don't think I need to go into any great details of medicals, but it went through the whole medical, because there wasn't any point in passing you through the testing system if you were unfit. So it was eyesight and hearing and blood pressure and breathing and so on and so forth. And we were billeted it must have been about 24 to a billet. And there was a very old corporal. When I say old, I mean a First World War chap. Who Corporal Langford. Never forget Corporal Langford. He had a funny expression, "Smarter with you," he used to say, when anybody was looked a bit down in the mouth. But he acted like a father to all of us. And we went through the various selection processes.
Do you remember what they were?
Pardon?
Do you remember what the selection processes were?
I can't really. It was some make a square pegs and round holes and that type of testing. It was all making circle and comparing. Can't really remember what it was about, basically.
Okay.
But you went through it step by step, and you finished up with with an assessment. It took the whole process took best part about 6 days,
days.
Pardon?
This is all July.
September.
September. Sorry.
No, it was bigger. It was August actually.
August. Right. Sorry,
it was
wrong.
Actually August because the date of attestation is the 9th of September. So it must have been. It was that period. It was a week some before that. It must have been probably roughly. It was definitely August, back end of August, beginning of September. So finally, when we had gone through all these devious things and tests and medical results, of course, had been published in the meantime. Some of the guys had been sent home because they were unfit. There was a few guys sent home afterwards. But then when it came to the end product, we must have been attested and agreed because we were given our uniform, we were sworn in, and we were given the King's shilling. And we were given our service number and our trades. Now, my service number, the whole of the boy entrance system started at 550-00-00, 550-FA. That was the guy who used to call him FA when he had no number at all. That's 3/3. No. And the trades were split up between photographers, under training photographers. There was only about 25 of these, as far as my memory serves me. Most of them were wireless operators going to Cranwell, and there's 45 of us were selected for armament training. I was one of the 45, and my number was 550-006.
So you would be training as an armourer?
I was going to be then. I was known then as a boy UT armourer. Boy entrance stroke UT armourer, under training armourer.
And so how did that please you? I mean, was that what you wanted, armourer, or would you prefer the photographer?
Quite frankly, it didn't make the slightest difference. Well, I suppose it did. I would like to have been a photographer, but I wasn't really worried because I wasn't really interested in radio operator, in spite of the fact my father's enthusiasm over it. I don't know if it would have done any good, actually. But anyway,
did you have it in mind that eventually you'd become either a pilot or air crew?
Oh, yes. Every boy's ambition was to get into the Air Force and become a sergeant pilot. I think without fear of contradiction, that was the aim.
So this was just a means to an end. I mean,
you had to get in, and you stood a better chance. Yeah, I mean, I would have had to have waited 2 years till I was 18 before I became in as an airman, and then you had the same same drag of getting on the ladder. You had to be a leading aircraftsman in a Group 1 or 2 trade anyway. So I was getting in on a Group 2 trade as opposed to Holton Apprentice, which is a Group 1. The subtle difference was that our training only lasted 2 years as opposed to Holton's, which would be 3 years.
So your attestation date was in early September, 34.
Effective 9th of September. That's my certificate on the wall says I was recruited into the service, and that's the day that my date starts. Everything starts 9th of September.
What happened then? So
just after the attestation, we got our... went up to Uxbridge to get our kit.
Now, tell me about... You kitted out at Uxbridge.
Yeah, well, no. We, yes, Yeah, we were kitted. With Uxbridge, yeah, there were stores supplied us with a kit, and we came back to West Drayton.
Now, what were you kitted out with?
Pardon?
What were you kitted out with?
Oh, dear.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I think so. Knife, fork, spoon, comb, toothbrush, razor, housewife, a hold all, button stick. I remember those because you had three sets of pajamas. Being boys, we had pajamas, we had shirts without collars, we had two caps, two uniforms. No, I tell a lie, with two uniforms, two jackets, one pair of pantaloons, one pair of trousers, two pairs of boots. Underwear, long johns type of underwear, PT kit, three sets, PT kit, plimsolls, three pairs of socks, cap badges, of course, badges to wear on our sleeves. We had a four-bladed propeller as our insignia, which we wore on the bottom of our left sleeve. The tunics in these days were close-up tunics, not collar and tie. We didn't have any collars. We just had shirts, a pair of braces, and laces for one boot, leather laces, and putties which you roll round your legs. Now, Corporal Langford, being an old sweat and in charge of us, when we got back to West Drayton, it was his job to instruct us in how to put these putties on. And for those people who have never worn putties, they're diabolical. There's a knack. It can take you hours or no time at all once you've mastered them. And you had to roll them around your legs. They're cut on a camber, and they roll them around your legs. They were a wartime, First World War thing, but they were blue, of course, and they had to be fastened in a specific way. We had to practice for hours and hours doing these. The pantaloons, of course.
Was there a secret to the putties? I mean, what was the secret?
Yeah, there is a secret. I can't remember what it was. Yeah, you had to start it in a spartan. You didn't have to roll them tight. You let it flow. You started in a given spot and you rolled it round.
Pardon? What did you think of them as a garment? I mean, were they stupid, or were they practical? I mean, because some people, I mean, I'm pointing out.
Well, we only wore them. We never thought anything about it. It was part of our best uniform. That was, and when you went out, you had to wear, in these days, you had to wear your uniform when you went out for the first 12 months.